brothers and sisters.
Give me a moment with your friend. I've never been on trial for my thoughts before.
Welcome to the Only One Mic podcast. Call Jerob, Brooklyn Dre. J Rob is off. We're joined by a very, very special returning guest coming to join us once again, Dr. Paris Woods. How you doing, Doc?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be back.
Yes, and we're happy to have you back. And as a lot of our listeners know, Dr. Paris Woods is the author of The Black Girl's Guide to Financial Freedom. So, like I was telling you behind the scenes, Paris, that last episode when you came on and we had our conversation about getting to the financial freedom, you know, getting to the bag and everything, as we said, that was very informative. And we had a lot of people that was hitting us up, you know, asking us questions. And I'm like, I'm not the financial expert. She was already on here, you know what I mean? Right. So it was like questions that I couldn't answer and things like that. But I said, I definitely wanted to have you back on the show to, you know, give some new perspective, being that it is Financial Literacy Month. So I couldn't let the month go out without having you on. So, Paris, if you can, for those that's just now tuning in and, you know, getting in tune with the show, can you please give us a little bit of your background?
Yeah, so I am a native St. Louisan, which I always start there because it's definitely been a full circle place for me to be from. Mm-hmm. But grew up sort of in your stereotypical low-income family, right? Which unfortunately, especially with what's going on in the economy and what's going on with all these layoffs, a lot of people are finding themselves in that situation. So it can be more typical than we would like for it to be. But definitely grew up experiencing lack. You know, we moved around a lot and I have to think back to remember, like, what was it like to sleep in my mom's car? Or to sleep in family members' basements or to spend time living in housing projects. Like all of those things are part of my experience growing up. And, you know, I had a very loving and supportive mother and family who encouraged education for me. And so I did well in school and education became my personal ticket out of poverty. So I ended up getting a full scholarship to Harvard University, where I did my bachelor's and master's degrees and went right into education because it was such a powerful lever for me. And I wanted other folks to have access and have been working in education for 20 years. So I still sort of work in education with the intention of helping young people access economic mobility. But certainly, I would say even after all those degrees and, you know, all these really cool work experiences, certainly realized that I had not received a financial education. And so at age 30, you know, we have all kind of wake up calls at age 30, right?
Yeah, like I thought, right.
Guys get married at age 30, like all kind of things happen. But for me, age 30 was a financial wake up call. And so that's when I really had to pursue a financial education for myself and really start turning things around. And so the book that I wrote is really me retelling that story, reliving a lot of the mistakes that I made so other folks can learn from them. And then also helping folks either skip over some of those mistakes or recover from them and start to experience the kind of financial freedom that I really think, you know, we deserve.
Right. And now being that it's Financial Literacy Month, I guess financial literacy is the, you know, the precursor to financial discipline. Can you tell us what are some tips that you have in terms of being financially disciplined? And especially like the last time we spoke more to the younger people out here who kind of get money and it just pipes right through their hands and they get a bunch of useless things that they probably is not going to add up to nothing in about another 5 years. But that's a point of being, you know, undisciplined financially. So can you kind of give us some tips on what it takes to be financially disciplined?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if I were to go back to the person that I was at age 30, you know, I was following the rules that I had been given by society, right? So I got my fancy degrees and I thought I deserve a new car, right? So I went to a dealership and financed a new car. That first degree was free, but the second degree I paid all in loans, right? So I had student loans and then, you know, I got to get some dental work. I'll take out a loan for that, right? So, you know, by the time I was in age 30, I had accumulated quite a bit of debt. And, you know, I remember, you know, no one questioning me taking out loans or questioning me financing a car. And in my mind, I was doing the things you're supposed to do. Like you're supposed to have credit cards and a car note and all of those things. So, you know, the first thing I think we have to ask ourselves or really challenge is our thinking around the role of money and the role of debt. And it's why I spend the whole first half of the book talking about debt, like reframing how debt is used and sort of some of the ways that debt can harm us, particularly if we want to be building financial freedom, right? So instead of paying back debt, we could be investing for the future. And so often the reason why we don't have wiggle room in our budgets is because we're making debt payments. So, you know, the first part of financial discipline has to do with the mindset, like a mindset around the money that you're bringing in, what your goals are with that money, and then the choices you're making as it leaves your hands. Hopefully keeping more of it over time instead of spending it, investing it so that it grows over time. And, you know, at the end of the day, the big thing I'm pushing is automating the process. So, you know, I'm as regular a person as they come. Like getting into debt is easy for me. When I see something nice, I want to get it. Right. And so for me, in order to master my behavior, it required automations. It required sort of setting up systems around myself to make it easy to make good choices and make it hard to make bad choices or choices that didn't align with my personal goals. So that when the inevitable temptations arise throughout the month, I didn't succumb to them. So those are just, you know, some things that made the biggest difference for me. First of all, shifting my mindset around money. And then second of all, creating the systems around myself so that I could be automating the choices that would lead me to the goals that I had set for myself.
So when you say invest, I mean, how did you start? I mean, when you had this, you know, you had this change of mindset in your 30s, when you say invest, what did you start off investing in? I mean, like, did you start off something simple like 401k, or I mean, did you go into the stock market, or how did you start off?
Yeah, so I, like many of us, because I was on my debt freedom journey, was reading and listening to Dave Ramsey. Okay, and so, you know, he, as part of the baby steps, recommended starting to put away a percentage of your income in your 401k. So that is where I started. And then, you know, as I started feeling more in control of my money, started seeing momentum, started seeing the debt disappear, I started reading more about investing and sort of thinking about, well, what is the purpose of this? Like, what am I creating in my life? And so often I think like identifying the purpose, identifying the why is the missing piece for all of us who know what we should be doing with our money, right? We all have an idea, a list of things that we should be doing differently. But the reason why we're not taking action on those things is because we really don't have a compelling reason why. Like, what kind of life are we trying to create on the other side of making these different choices? So, you know, I happened to land upon a blog of a guy who was following the FIRE, Financial Independence, Retire Early movement, and just started reading it, just started learning about this community of people who were investing to give themselves sort of the ultimate freedom, which is the ability to live without needing to work. You can continue to work, you can work on and off, you can do projects, right? But for you to be able to choose to go to work because you want to be there and because you don't need that next paycheck. And that was compelling to me. You know, freedom is one of my core values. And so it sort of opened up this whole new world to me about what freedom could look like. And, you know, even though it was a white guy's blog I was reading, you know, as a Black woman, I had to say, well, wait a minute. Like, I think there's a deeper meaning here to be a Black woman, to have, you know, ancestors who were enslaved in this country, and to have gotten all these opportunities. Like, my community poured so much into me. And so to think about, you know, what what might these people have dreamed of for me? Like, what price has already been paid that I just need to walk into? And so the financial freedom, the financial independence movement resonated with me for that purpose. And so because of that resonance, I really started following the tenets of that investment strategy, which is very similar. So we're still talking about 401ks. At a certain point, you know, many people don't know you can actually max out your 401k. Like, there's a limit to how much money you can put in there. So thinking about other places, you know, opening a Roth IRA, if you meet the income requirements, because there's also an income limit, and even just opening up a regular brokerage account. So in terms of the accounts, but what's unique about the FIRE movement is that there's a very simple investing philosophy using index funds. And that resonated with me as well. So just thinking about the math and the science, like, people have run all sorts of simulations to prove why index funds are actually the smartest investment strategy and not just the simplest, but that resonated with me as well. So that's been the investment strategy that I've been following since then.
Did you have any growing pains starting everything off? I mean, my only reason I'm asking, because I had growing pains. I mean, I had the same idea at 30, well, not at 30, but at 35, whereas I started like going directly into the stock market. I think I took like 15% out of my check and I went directly into my 401k. I think I put like 9% in a regular 401k. The other I put into a Roth. And my growing pains came going like directly into the stock market, whereas I didn't get index funds initially. You know what I mean? I was actually just trying to get whatever I could get for cheap. You know what I mean? I started off like that and I lost a few dollars in that. Then, you know, I had the growing pains coming up. Did you have the same thing or no? Did you just, you know, did your research first and then, you know, everything kind of worked out smoothly?
Oh man. Yeah. I wish I were that good. Right. Things that always go smoothly. Right. I'll make a mistake. Like, that's what can be true. And figure it out and sort of come around to something that works better. So right. I've been the type of person to read about money, ever since, you know, I was 16 and my friend's dad handed me a copy of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, right? Money has been on my mind. And so I had a Roth IRA, right out of college. Like, in my first job, I set up a Roth IRA.
Okay.
And, you know, the mistake that I made that so many folks make is raiding that money, right? So you save it up over time, you're doing well, some emergency comes up and or something you just want, and you go in there and raid the funds. So nowadays, you know, when I talk about investing, I talk about this as the most common mistake, but I also talk about sort of the difference between what the number in your brokerage account means and the number in your checking account, right? Or your savings account. Because a lot of folks think when they open up their brokerage account and see $10,000, that's the money that they have in that account.
Right.
That's not true. That $10,000 actually represents the value of the investments that you own. So,
right.
You might own, who knows, 100 shares. And even if the value goes down, you still own that 100 shares. And so I think, you know, for folks who see the number go down and start to freak out and they sell their shares, now you've just sold those shares at a discount. Like, you still owned them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for folks who follow FIRE, one of the big studies that these folks have looked at is a study called the Trinity Study. Which looked at these 30-year periods in history. And they tracked all the way through the entire history of the stock market. So we're talking about the Great Depression, right? Like, the entire history of the tracked stock market. And over any 30-year period in history, the market has gone up. And it's gone up by around 7%. For the past 100 years, that number is around 10%. And so sort of what these folks do when you run the numbers is you start to realize that if all you did, if your entire investing strategy was to buy index funds that track even the entire stock market, just a total stock market index fund, and left it there for 30 years, you would make at least 7 to 10% on your money, if not more. And you might be in a really lucky 30 years, right, where that number is much north, much farther north. And so it sort of reduces the stress and reduces sort of the anxiety around constantly checking your account, constantly checking, am I up, am I down? Do I need to sell? Do I need to buy? Removes all of that anxiety. And it's really just a buy and hold strategy for folks who are investing for the long, long, long term. So I like that. I like low stress. I like low anxiety. I'm like, life is stressful enough. I can't be stressed opening up my broker account and looking at the number. So that was a lesson that I had to learn the hard way as well.
So the people that you, you know, the people that the young people that you talk to, I mean, that, you know, you encourage them to finally invest and get into the stock market. I mean, how do you talk them out of not, you know, taking money when things start going the wrong way? I mean, because I noticed I've been working with, I don't counsel anybody, but, you know, because I started investing and I started getting good with it over the years. So now when I see a young person that might work with me or something like that, I might give them, you know, what I know, and they start. And then you got to tell them, like, listen, you got to calm down. You know, if you're going to, you might lose a few dollars or something. Well, you're not losing money. Like you said, you still got the shares. So as long as you invest into, you know, like you said, an index company, something that's on the, you know, S&P or something like that, then you should be all right, you know. So how do you keep people from, you know, cringing and pulling out their money and getting out of there early?
Yeah, that's the hardest part, right? Like, right, we can all remember when we were young and who the things we didn't listen to. Mm-hmm. So what I tell young people to do, and even older people, is to make sure we're doing things in the right sequence. So we don't start with investing. We start with saving and making sure that you have a robust emergency fund in place for the unexpected things that we know will inevitably arise. Right. Like, your car is going to break down. You're going to have a medical expense, like some emergency is going to come up in your family. And you never want to put yourself in a place where you're so stressed for money that you now got to make choices that don't align with your values. Whether that means going into debt, whether that means raiding the money that belongs to your future self. And so the way we prevent that is by creating an emergency fund. Good rule of thumb, 3 to 6 months worth of your bills in that emergency fund before you even start filling up your investment fund, which is long-term money. So that's where I start. And hopefully, you know, if folks buy in to the buy and hold long-term strategy, I would say don't even look at the brokerage account. Like, don't even tempt yourself. Automate the money that goes in there, get it straight out of your paycheck, and just pretend it doesn't exist. Like, if you could forget about it and wake up 30 years from now and have a lot of money in there, that's the best case scenario. Especially if you're like me and good for temptation, then we got to get it out of our awareness, out of our daily decision-making, and just automate it as much as we can.
Started to laugh. I said, you sound like Fannie Willis when you said you keep 6 months of money in the house.
Yeah, right, the stash in the house.
Yeah. You know, that's another generation from mine. So I'm going to have mine in a savings account, but I appreciate her just having that cash.
Right.
So, you know, as you mentioned, you know, off air that you were about to get married, and I wanted to say congratulations on that one.
Congrats, huh?
Yeah, definitely. And starting your new life and all. So let's talk about family. Mm-hmm. You know, how does this work? Because I'm looking at the Pew Research and they're saying, like, the median income for the Black family in the U.S. household is $50,000. It's $50,000. So, what are some tips you can have as a family in terms of, like, managing debt?
Ooh, yes. So this is also reminding me of an important thing for us to note, which is that we cannot budget our way out of poverty. So, you know, I talk about making, managing, and multiplying money. Like, it starts with making money. And on average, we understand that people of color are underpaid. Black women especially are historically and tremendously underpaid. And so it's hard to do any of this unless you're bringing in more money, right, in the front door. So that's where I start. And that's where I encourage people, when you're thinking about, I don't have enough money, you can do the budgeting, you can work on saving and all of that, but I really would emphasize working on earning and earning more. So I think that's a good place to start. It's so interesting then thinking about combining your finances with another person because, you're bringing more money, right? So now you got two incomes, but you also got two personalities and two sets of values and two you know, spending habits and all of that. So it's not just as easy as getting double the income if you are with someone who makes the same amount. But it's back through that same values process. So when folks ask me, how do I get my husband on the same financial plan? How do I get my wife? Well, wait a minute. Like, that's not where we start. Right. Let's start with why. Like, what are y'all creating? Mm-hmm. What is the future that you're dreaming of for yourself? Why would you bother doing any of this stuff unless there's some deeper reason? So that's where I start. And that's where I encourage other folks, particularly in relationships. We got to start with the why.
And you got to think about that before you get married, too.
That's right.
Yeah, you got to discuss that before you get married. And it's good that you said, you know, you got to increase your income, because I think that's the biggest problem. I noticed that with, you know, some people I talk to about, you know, trying to invest and stuff like that, because I'm like, you know, you can budget all you want, but if you don't have the money, there's nothing really that you can do. And sometimes I tell people, which they, you know, it seems like it's hard to do, I'm like, you might have to get a second job, especially if you don't, you know, you don't have that type of job that, you know, where you make that kind of money where you can do those type of things. So, you know, sometimes you got to double up and get that second job.
You might need a third or fourth. It's in 2024, the way things are rolling. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's how I had that light bulb moment myself. I mean, I was getting out of debt and it occurred to me, I need more money to get this done faster. And so I started taking on side hustles and doing consulting, right? And just working, seemed like every hour. It's incredibly exhausting. So I don't think that's a long-term plan.
Right.
I think at the time I was probably making $75,000 as an executive director of a nonprofit. And then I was bringing in enough side hustle money to like push me over six figures. And so that was a moment where I started to think, you know, like, wouldn't life be great if I just had a six-figure job? Like, if I could just, in my 9-to-5, make six figures? I'd be healthier. I'd be happier. I could make better decisions. I'd be more creative, right? And so that, I think, was the beginning of me starting to think, you know, I actually just need to make more. Like, it's not about me, trading more of my life away. It's about me charging more for every hour of my life that I'm giving to a job. So I would encourage folks, especially, you got to do what you got to do. So if you're working two and three jobs, that's fine. But at the end of the day, I want you to also start brainstorming. What could it look like to make more? And then let's start to think about the types of roles or opportunities that could drive your regular day job income up.
Yeah. Also, you're kind of unicorn. That's $75,000.
That was already a lot, right? I know. Above that $50,000. Right. I'm also an overachiever. So I'm like, ooh.
Right.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
That's the next goal. Yeah, I'm steady pushing it.
Mm-hmm. So it was something that you was telling me about, Dre, about the like a family investing plan.
Yeah, you know, recently I've been trying to get my family to get together and get like a group investment, you know, where we all chip in and, you know, do maybe like a little couple of dollars a month or something like that to put together some money and put it into like an investment group. I mean, is that something that you suggest?
Yeah, it's sort of like, I'd be curious sort of what the goals are and what you guys are going to do with the money. But I've seen lots of examples of folks. Like, I have a friend whose entire family, it's sort of what they expect of the family to be given back. And he's Sudanese, so it's from a different culture,
right?
But because he had the opportunity to come to the U.S. and, you know, makes a lot more money than other folks, it's almost like tithing, but we're tithing back into the family.
Right.
So that really appealed to me, sort of thinking about like, what does it look like for us to pool our resources? And those of us who have more resources, we have a greater responsibility to think about what we're doing with those resources. Another great example, I have a friend who bought a couple hundred acres of land in rural Missouri, formerly Black-owned land in rural Missouri. And so getting it back into Black-owned hands, but has started, you know, a reparations project where she's accepting donations and then has a community board that decides where they invest that money back into the community. So it's not, you know, straight out like investing in index funds, but more so investing back into the community. So I think all of those are great ideas. It's like folks who have a shared vision and want to join together and do something collectively. I mean, you can't lose.
Yeah, I think we got to do this more in the Black community, because I used to work at Bank of New York some years ago, and I used to work kind of like in that area. And I used to, you know, see all of these investment groups come through. And I'm like, man, this, I used to think like an investment group was something that you did with your job or some sort of business or something like that at the time. And I didn't know that, you know, just a couple of family members or something like that could just get together and start something. And I used to look at, you know, some of their reports and everything. And I'm like, wow, these guys got a lot of money in this fund. You know what I mean? So, you know, I just wanted to see, you know, it's something I was telling my brother. I was like, man, I want to see our nieces and nephews and everything like that get involved in this type of thing. That way, if, you know, somewhere down the line, if the family wants to start some businesses and different things like that, then we can also do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
use that money to do so.
It's like folks, for example, I invest with a friend of mine who does multi-unit real estate development. And, you know, it's all legal, right? Like, I'm not just handing her money and saying, I hope I get a return on this. Like, there are documents to be signed, et cetera. But it's like, there's power in aggregating funds to make even larger investments than you could do alone. So, you know, for folks who are just getting started and just trying to, like, what is a 401k? Like, start there, learn. But we have additional resources to pool, you know, do your research, make sure that the things that are being done with your money agree, like align with your values. And then let's aggregate the funds and do bigger and better.
What are your thoughts on cryptocurrency?
Oh man, this is the one I hate. you know what
you
I do?
Tell us why you hate it. Tell us why you hate
it. What I do? I follow the advice of people who have more money than I do, who are smarter than I am, right? So I like to go to conferences of folks who are already financially independent and wealthy and not working and just living off their investments to see, well, what are you doing with your money? Like, are we out here playing games with our money or are you still following the strategies? And so what I have heard folks saying is that even though cryptocurrency itself feels very much like speculating, like it's a very risky thing to do with your money, they are investing in companies that are investing in the blockchain. So the blockchain is the technology. Like that's the technological advancement that cryptocurrency is built on. And so it's like, why not invest in the organizations that are investing in the technology that whatever the next iteration, the cryptocurrency that becomes mainstream. I mean, there are hundreds of cryptocurrencies, right? Let's say the world does make that turn. You sort of have your money. You're sort of betting on the technology. And even still, those folks are saying that's our fun money. Like that's 10%, no more than 10% of my portfolio that I'm doing for fun. And the rest is just in our stable, predictable investments that we know are going to do well over time. So that would be my recommendation.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Good recommendation. Because what did you say? You follow people who are making money, I guess, or who are good at it, you know, in so many words. And I think that's one of the what is it? It's not the laws, but, you know, what is that book? Richest Man in Babylon. I read or something like that years ago.
I took that lesson to heart. I'm not taking your advice if you haven't been where
I'm going. Right. And that was one of like the biggest things in there, because I was like, again, you know, when I first started out investing, I think I should have probably took somebody else's and, you know, somebody's advice and stop, you know, just not jump in it and waste money and stuff like that. So that's good.
Now people, I mean, the great thing is for those of us who didn't mess some stuff up and learn the hard way, at least we can give advice and folks can, you know, skip a couple steps.
So speaking of advice, I mean, just off the cuff, what is the worst financial advice you ever heard or actually have received? What's like the worst thing you can
heard? Buying life insurance.
Oh, speak on it. Buy life insurance.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, there's all kind of bad advice, but it's one of the ones that irks me because like we work hard for our money, right? Like I really believe we're trading valuable hours, like the hours of our life are the things we can't get back. It's an unrenewable resource. It's the most valuable possession we have. So if you trade that for money, like what you do with that money is so important. And I don't want people to be taken advantage of. So often I see so many TikToks about this. It's like a thing. Because a lot of people get into jobs where their job is to sell life insurance, to tell people this is an investment. And going to get rich and this is what the rich do, et cetera. It's complicated and there are fees and there, you know, there's all these ways for you to lose your money. And, you know, people, I feel like are getting swindled over like a hope and a dream, when there's really just like the things we're talking about are so simple. Like anyone listening to this today could go to their job and put some money in their 401k and find an index fund, or go to Vanguard and open a Roth IRA, right? It's so simple. And we have been led to believe that these things have to be complicated and that you're not smart enough to do it. So you got to give your money to me and then I'm going to make you rich. And we just got to, that just troubles me. Like, I really hate to hear it. And I hate to hear
it. Yeah. That's the beautiful thing I think now, because, like I said, I mean, when, you know, when my parents were coming up, you know, this stuff was, you know, you had to go get a broker and all that other stuff like that. Like now everything is pretty much at your fingertips. You can go online, you can start your brokerage account and do your own thing. So, you know, no longer need really like a middleman to do anything. I mean, if nothing else, you just need somebody to give you some information or, you know, start you out, but you really don't need to give anybody any money to get money. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. You can get a book. My book is in the library. Like, you literally don't have to pay anyone any money to get this information.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is that a lot of people don't look for these things, especially with our young people. Like, I was talking to someone the other day who said, well, we were talking about credit. And the person said, well, I have a house. And once I got my house, I didn't care about my credit anymore. So, you know, this is like the mentality that a lot of people have, but not knowing that you're going to probably need this somewhere down the line for something else. So like, what's the best advice you can give young people in terms of credit? Because a lot of them don't really understand it. So could you kind of break that down and give a message to the young people in terms about keeping a healthy credit history?
Ooh, yeah, it's multiple sides to this. Yeah, I think this is the number one question young people want to ask. Like, if I'm on a panel or something with young people for questions, they want to know, tell me about credit scores. Like, how low can it go? How do I build it? Right. And it's one of those interesting things about society that every young person knows about a credit score, but every young person doesn't know about an index fund. Right.
Right.
So I'm struggling with that. But I'm like, we got to start, meet people where they are, and then we can layer on some information. For the credit score, you know, I like to remind folks like the top three things that we're even looking at with your credit score, has to do with your balances. Like, how are you maxing out these credit cards? Or are you keeping it around 30% or less? That's the golden ratio, 30% or less, of your balance. If you have $1,000 card, never put more than $300 on that card. Pay it off every month. So at the end of the month, it should be at 0%. But so the utilization rate is what that is called. And then the length of credit history, which you'll just build over time. And then thinking about what the third one is. I lost it off the top of my head. Oh, on-time payments, of course. So making sure you pay your bills on time. I think those are reasonable. Like, I think if you, you know, charge something, paying the money back is a reasonable expectation. So I think for young people, you know, part of it, we're talking about your integrity. We're talking about making wise choices. We're talking about, and I think, you know, I'm not a fan of credit cards because I've gotten bitten a lot. By being an overspender, by saying, oh, I'm just going to charge a little bit more this month and I'm going to pay myself back and all this. Like, my brain can do all of those things. So my recommendation is to set up really strong guardrails for yourself. I like to say, you know, find a bill, a recurring bill, your phone bill or something like this. Set it up on that credit card for auto pay. And then don't carry the credit card around in your wallet, right? Like, it's not for everyday expenses. If you're just building credit, put a bill on there, pay that bill every month, and your credit score is going to go up. And put the credit, you could cut the credit card up and throw it in the trash, right? Like, after you've got it set up on auto pay, what are you going to, you're not going to be swiping the card. So I would encourage folks to be cautious, to listen to their adults around them who've gotten themselves in credit card debt and know how easy it is to sort of be caught in the debt trap. And then to build those smart guardrails so that you don't sort of fall into the same traps that a lot of us have.
Would you suggest to overinvest in your 401k? Like, you know, recently, I mean, I've done it I gave like 15%. And I think at the time my job was matching like 6% or something like that. And recently someone was telling me that once I got knowledge to get into, you know, investing myself directly into the market, he was like, well, why are you putting the rest of that money in there? You might as well just invest it yourself. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So once you get to the part, to the point of your life where you've got all the basics done, right? You've got your emergency fund set up, you got your income straight, right? Folks will remind you that the greatest culprit, the greatest thing that's going to eat into your money is taxes. And so,
so we gotta
start getting smart about our tax strategies. And this is why we start with, you know, these tax advantage accounts. Even better than the 401k is the Roth IRA. So what a lot of folks will do, if you have enough money to be maxing out these accounts, or you're trying to build up to it, is to start with the match if you have that at work, because that's, I mean, you're automatically doubling your money. Right. Then to go max out a Roth, max out the Roth IRA, which, you know, for folks who are learning about Roths, it's after-tax money. So you've already paid the taxes, but all the growth, so years down the line when you take the money out, all that money is tax-free.
Right.
And that, I mean, it can't be beat, which is why there's a limit on how much money you can put into a Roth. If you make too much money, they start to cap who can put money into a Roth. And you got to, you know, there's some tricks you got to start doing to find ways to access it. So max out the Roth and then go back and max out your 401k, which is another tax advantage account. So folks are always going to try to max out the tax advantaged accounts. Some folks will have HSAs, which is another tax advantage account through, you know, your healthcare. So, you know, maxing out the tax advantages is key. And then beyond that, of course, you can go get a regular brokerage account. That's certainly fine, but I would max those out first.
That's good information right there. Good information.
Yeah, most definitely. So now we're going to switch gears. Let's talk about the book. Okay. I just want to follow up with you on the book. I know you said, it was, you know, you mentioned this in the libraries now, all this information is there. What is the feedback that you've been getting on the book since you put it out? Like, I know you got to get a plethora of notes and emails and
oh my goodness.
People dropping in your DMs, all type of stuff like that. So just tell us, you know, the book, tell us about the book and how it's, you know, affecting people out here.
Yeah, no, the book, I mean, I have been completely blown away. I think when I wrote the book, so I had this burning desire to just get this information out. I'm like, how come nobody told me this? How come people in my community aren't talking about this? I'm just going to bring my Black woman voice and do it, right? Like, it just had to be written. But even, so we put the book out 2021, and almost $90,000 books have been sold to date. And just
wonderful.
No, it's crazy. So when I say blown away, like, I'm blown away in multiple ways, including the sales, but people are constantly reaching out to me to say, this book has changed my life. I suddenly have hope. I finally took action on something I've been meaning to do. Mm-hmm. So there's something about, I think, if I were thinking about what made the difference, because I read a lot of books, like there are a ton of personal finance books,
right.
Is being able to connect with the stories in the books I'm telling, you know, my personal story, but being able to see someone you can relate to, make these mistakes, recover from them, right, starts to make you think you can do it too. And because my background is in education, you know, I definitely approached it from this sort of action oriented. It's almost like a textbook. I have worksheets in there, right? Like, I really want you to take action on these things and to make it digestible and easy enough to understand. So that was my hope. And so I feel like, you know, it's such a blessing for people to say, yeah, I did do that. Yeah, I used the tool that you gave me and I opened that account, you know. So I'm just so grateful that folks are receiving it and that it's actually making a difference for folks.
You know, it's funny to say, because I was telling my brother this and I was like, you know, because once you start investing and you start getting money or you start watching your money grow, you know, you get kind of excited about it, right? And I was telling them that, you know, a lot of times I'll speak to people at work and we'll just talk about it. And then it kind of makes you happy when that person actually goes out and actually starts their own brokerage account and stuff like that. So, you know, and then they'll come back and ask questions. And I got one young lady that works with me right now, man, and like, she's gung-ho every Friday. She's like, you know, Andre, what do I invest in today? What am I putting my money into? And I'm like, oh, wow, you know, it's beautiful to watch her, you know, you know, be young. And I said, man, I wish I was that young and somebody gave me that information. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, time is on your side. It's so tricky because when you're young, you want to make mistakes. That's how you're going to learn. But for those young people who are willing to take advice, find good people to take advice from and willing to take it. Like just time alone, it takes so much less money to build wealth if you start early than if you start, you know, in your 40s. Like I'm 40 now, right? So like if you're at my age or older, we got to, you know, we got to move some bigger numbers to get where right. we're trying to go. Right. Even for those of us, even if you are moving bigger numbers, you can pay that forward by mentoring a young person to start early with those smaller numbers and get there faster.
That's right.
Have any of the big name, like financial quote unquote gurus reached out to you probably after seeing you speak or, you know, reading your book or hearing someone talk about you and, you know, try to pick your brain about certain things?
I don't know about that. I will tell you when I was writing the book, I reached out to a lot of folks to say, will you read my book? You know, will you give me some feedback? And I was so lucky to get yeses from some of my favorite people. And so their names are like in the cover. Like those are people I personally reached out to say, will you read my book and review it? And was able to put their quotes in there. And then I loved, so for a while, my book came out at the same time, around the same time as Tiffany Alishay's book, The Budgetista. Mm-hmm. So I remember someone had posted something on Instagram about both of these books. And she replied and said, I love your book, Paris, you know, which was so dope. I'm like, ma'am, you are a celebrity. you know, so just those little things have really stood out to me, but I haven't, you know, gotten on the phone with anyone or anything like that.
Well, at least not yet. At least not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I remember, like, I'm not a big fan of Dr. Umar Johnson, but I remember in the beginning when he was talking about starting school and stuff like that. And that was one of the things that I was intrigued by because he was saying that how he was going to teach kids financial literacy and teach them how to invest and stuff like that. And I was like, man, like, you know, he's a little weird for me here and there, but I was like, it would be nice to see somebody that would come through, that could come through and start a program like this. And like you said, start children out early and understanding, you know, what's going on as opposed to waiting until, you know, you get 30 or 40 and trying to put things together, you know, on a global scale or, you know, not, well, just, you know, all over the United States, I should say, if nothing else, you know, especially in the community, in our community.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I feel like schools are hungry for this information. A lot of states are starting to require some sort of financial literacy course for students in K-12. So there's certainly appetite for it. I just want to make sure that we have people of color represented and folks, you know, let's make it interesting. Let's make it entertaining. It doesn't have to be dry and boring and, you know, banker boring is what I call it. Hopefully we can bring some diverse voices into the classrooms as well.
Yeah, a teacher friend of mine actually did that with her fifth grade class where they had like an investment team. They were in like a competition and actually won in terms of the investment team had to pick, I guess it was companies or stocks that they had to get together and invest in. They watched mm-hmm. The stocks grew, and the competition, I believe, was whose stock was the highest at the end. So they competed against other schools for this. And I thought that was so cool, but it was something that was not publicized. And I'm like, why is not the whole school doing this? Or, you know, I know she probably reached out to someone to get this started, a person like yourself. So it's like, why is the whole school not doing something like this? Why is the whole, it's not a curriculum based around this. It still baffles me till this day.
Yeah. Hopefully maybe someone listening to this is going to be inspired just like I was to write the book, to create the curriculum that normalizes, because I think the risk, I feel like most often we see investment clubs, the risk is sort of this gamification of investing when really investing should be boring and basic and just like, this is what we all do, of course. Like, of course, right. You have money, you're broke. Okay. And so I think someone's got to get creative to make that engaging in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So folks understand just the basics of what to do with your money to build wealth without having to do all the extra stuff.
Exactly. Gotcha. So is there going to be a second book that you're working on? I know you got a lot going on right now, but are we getting that Black Man's Guide to Financial Freedom that we talked about last?
Maybe Dr. Umar is going to write it. I don't know.
I don't know if I'd give Dr. Umar my money at this point. I don't know.
I'm waiting. You know, I'm open to inspiration. It was inspiration that struck that resulted in this book. So if it hits me, I will do it. We'll see. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Maybe you should do something autobiographical, you know?
Yeah. You never know. Is my life interesting enough? So maybe on this other side, we can talk about being married and all the other. I know there's more for me to learn in this next week. So we'll see.
plus more money to make. Now you can split it down the middle, you know, throw a lot of more money into it, you know.
Yeah, the complexity. Even like I might become a mom, you never know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's lots more lessons to learn that I'm happy to turn them around.
God bless you with that mom thing.
Yeah. Definitely.
God bless you.
I'll tell you what, that kid is gonna be sharp when it comes to investing.
Oh yeah, man. God, yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah. No money mistakes here. All right. So before we let you go, can you let everybody know what your handles are, where they can reach you at, where they can get the book at? Let us know what's going on.
Yeah. Author Paris Woods on all social platforms. And then the book is available everywhere as well. The lowest price I've seen is on Amazon, and that might be the best place to start. And then I have a free toolkit that you can download. And the URL is right on the inside of the book, but it's just pariswoods.com/book bonuses, with just some extra trainings and things like that to get you started.
Okay. Now, and I see you getting out there on the socials, making your shorts and everything like that, keeping the people informed. I'm loving it. I just want to let everybody know, go out there, find her. You know what I mean? If you're on the Instagrams and all of that, and check out a lot of this stuff, YouTube and all, check it out. All right. So Dr. Paris Woods, thank you once again on a mission to help more women of color build wealth while living a life they love.
That's right.
We appreciate you for that one. That's for real. All right. And with that being said, we're going to get ready to sign off. So, yeah, thanks again for once again, another informative conversation. All right. The Only One Mic Podcast is available on all platforms you stream your podcasts on. Also, check out our Only One Mic Podcast YouTube channel to catch up on the past and current episodes. And please don't forget to rate the show and subscribe. Check us out on Instagram and X/Twitter at The Only One Mic P1, Facebook and LinkedIn at The Only One Mic Podcast. And you can email us at theonlyonemic00@gmail.com or call us at 302-367-7219 to have your comments and questions played on the show. We thank you once again for your time, Dr. Paris Woods, to you, the audience. And we encourage you to please speak your truth quietly and clearly and listen to others, even the dull and the ignorant, because they too have their story to tell. So until next time, please keep in mind. In fact, this one is a good one, Paris. Each one teach one. If you can't find one, talk to the little ones and you'll see they'll listen to fill the missing piece to rise and shine. Thank you, everybody, for showing up, and peace.
Peace.